Well, you are listening to Meeting House here on Faith Radio. It is great to welcome to the program U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel retired Sargis Sangari. He is the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, founder of the United Assyrian Appeal. He saw extensive combat in the Middle East as a Special Operations Forces soldier, also after his retirement, continuing to advise the Assyrian Christian Army in Iraq that we're going to be talking about just a bit. And we're going to be discussing this overall situation that we are seeing emerge in the Middle East, centered on the activities of the nation of Iran. Lieutenant Colonel Sangari, thanks for joining us today here in the Meeting House on Faith Radio.
Bob, it's great to be here.
Well, I want to give you the opportunity as we begin to just talk about the work that you do. As I mentioned, you have served in the U.S. Army, and now you continue to be involved with an Assyrian Christian army. And I'll leave it to you to pronounce the name of the army there. But it just shows the situation there in Iraq with respect to the Assyrian Christians. Tell me just a bit about the work that you do in the nation of Iraq, as well as just the overall work of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement.
No, it'd be my pleasure, Bob. We established the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement after I retired in 2014, and I established it on September 11 in honor of the 3,000 Americans that were murdered on our soil. Since then, we have become an academic and operational policy study research institute and think tank that has provided political multi-analysis and assessments of the Middle East affairs for a diverse international clientele that represent both government and private interests. And in that capacity, the Assyrian people went through a genocide, the most recent genocide in 2014. And when the commander of forces on the ground came to us at that time, they were known as the Duhnosha, he asked for support. And we told him that the U.S. will not provide you any support. That's the reality. You have to do it on your own. And through our advisory capacity to them, the Assyrian army was able to conduct major unilateral offensive and defensive operations both in Iraq and Syria, some of which, to this day, we don't talk about, but eventually will be spoken about in the near future. The Office of Secretary of Defense was given a briefing plan by us as to how to clear the Mosul area for the follow-on offensive operation. It was called Operation Collective Action. Press media can request those through any means from the Office of Secretary of Defense. And at the same time, the State Department, Iraq desk, Syria desk were briefed by us. And we have provided briefings to the National Security Council on the issues of the Assyrians in the Middle East. The Assyrian army was removed off the battlefield after the Mosul fight was completed in Iraq, reason being because the Sunni Muslim Kurds and the Iraqi Arabs were about to engage in the fight when the Kurds decided to declare independence from Iraq. And we did not want to have the Assyrian Christian armed forces to be involved in that fight or had to choose a side between either the Iraqi Arab or the Kurdish Sunni Muslim Kurds. The United Assyrian Appeal, which is a 501c3, we established in 2015. It became a 501c3 in 2016. Provided money to the Assyrian military families. We still do today, which allowed the soldiers to fight. That force structure can be reconstituted anytime. It is still a viable force structure. We have just not allowed them to engage in any type of a fight that is taking place in the region between the various different Muslim elements currently. As the leader of the Assyrian multi-force structure, the commander-in-chief was elected to become a member of the parliament representing Assyrian Christians in Iraq. He has been able to push for a province to be recognized as self-governing for the Assyrian Christians and other groups, minorities. This force structure would come back and be able to secure that region in order for the minorities to be able to live in peace under a functional peace and administer themselves. Our worry is that within less than 10 years, you'll probably see a final genocide against the Assyrian Christians take place again in both Syria and Iraq. They are still being persecuted. They're being killed for their faith and for their ethnicity. More importantly, because of various different groups that are in Iraq and Syria are jockeying to be able to take the land that they have for themselves because it is very oil-rich area at the same time and has a lot of agriculture products, water, and the things that are needed to sustain nation states.
Well, you're listening to Meeting House here on Faith Radio. Sargis Sangari is joining us today and giving us really a briefing, if you will, about the, at this point, the status of Assyrian Christians there in the Middle East, in the area of Iraq, perhaps even into Syria. And you mentioned that you had an Assyrian Christian that really has been leading an effort in the Iraqi parliament to establish a province for Assyrian Christians, yet you didn't offer a particularly optimistic appraisal of what could be occurring in that region for the next 10 years. Elaborate just a bit. You say that, Assyrian Christians are still being persecuted by or for their faith. What is the situation there? What are the imminent threats against this group of people?
Well, you know, this week is the celebration of the Assyrian Memorial Day, where in 1933, August 7, 1933, the massacre of Somali took place, where Assyrian Christians were killed inside of their own country, in this case, Iraq, which they helped to establish as they served as the British levies during World War I, helping to defeat the Ottomans. They were killed inside the country of the nation that they believed to be their homeland by the standing army of that nation. This is the only time and the first time it has happened in the history of the 20th century. They were attacked by Sunni Muslim Kurd tribesmen, and they were also attacked by the Iraqi military itself. Today, Iraq, after the U.S. invasion into Iraq, has established itself on the grounds of an Islamic constitution. Even the current Christian leader of the Assyrian Armed Forces that has won a seat in parliament, and they're trying to force him out whichever means possibly out of his seat in order to ensure that what he's pushing for under the requirements of the Iraqi constitution that we had helped to establish from the U.S. side would not allow the Assyrian Christians to be able to administer their own region. It is an Islamic constitution. Sharia law is what governs what is going to be the future of the Assyrian Christians within the region. If the Assyrian Christians are not able to have their own little piece of land in their own historical homeland, as I have said multiple times before, your past is a harbinger of your future. This will lead to a final genocide that will eradicate the Christians. In 2016 and 2017, we introduced concepts to the National Security Council that really looked at the fact that since 2003, every plan that the United States or United Nations and other parties and nations had pursued in the region to bring about a functional peace in the Middle East had not adequately addressed the issues affecting the survival of the minorities in the region, and that a new approach was needed for us to get anywhere. So we introduced laudable elements based on the Iraqi constitution to be able to at least bring some validity to the survival of those Christian minorities. And one of the points was to enhance the national unity and the territorial integrity of those parties, specifically within a degree of a self-rule for them. The other piece was to be able to protect their territorial integrities of the nation, allowing those local governance to take place within the regions. And that also helps the psychological security of the people and the minorities, because nobody wants to stay there knowing that one day their own army might be able to be turned against them to kill them and eradicate them, as it was in 1933 Somali massacre. And then also to facilitate the establishment of some viable economy by decentralizing programs for economic development and then promoting the social justice overall for those minorities. The problem we have is that in 2003, the United States had all its multi-power in the region. NATO was there, European Union was there, our allies were there, and Assyrian Christians were butchered. And they went from 1.5 million all the way to where they are today, almost 150,000 left. So when U.S. was strong there, we weren't able to protect them. Today, U.S. somehow, somewhat is looked at as being a paper tiger within the region, even under the current POTUS. And there is probably no likelihood that any of the parties that are in the West are interested in the survival of the Christians, because they do not see them as a viable entity that is going to be able to support them in their long run as far as their strategic outlook is concerned. Because of that, the Assyrian Christians have to do it on their own with the support of the people in the West or other Christians. Otherwise, it will be eradicated.
Well, you're listening to Meeting House here on Faith Radio. Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari is joining us today, retired U.S. Army colonel, and he is giving us an idea of the situation there. So far, we've been talking about the Assyrian Christians and the perilous situation that they are in. I want to shift now to the nation of Iran. And, of course, a number of the news stories that we have been hearing recently have to do with the provocation on the seas, Strait of Hormuz, Persian Gulf region, where you've had Iraqi forces that have attacked a variety of different ships. You had the U.S. drone that had been eliminated or shot down, presumably by Iraqi forces not too long ago. What do you see from your knowledge of the Iranian government and Iranian politics and activities? What do you see as the situation as far as the menace that Iran has been on the seas here recently?
Everything that is happening in the region is the birth pains of us getting to a new deal with Iran. As you know, that the current POTUS walked away from the deal that was struck by the previous administration because he wanted a better deal. And it doesn't mean just because if he strike a new deal that this will be an enduring deal with Iran. Eventually, we have to get to a point where we can have a treaty with Iran. The issue of Iran is that not only is there an internal fight between the moderates and what you might want to call hardliners within the region. It is at the same time an internal conflict that Iran has been trying to deal with since the revolution. They still have not been able to answer the question as to why did we go through a revolution and why are we where we are today. At the same time, you have to add another friction point to this, which is an internal fight in Islam where various different leadership within Islam is trying to be the main spokesperson for Islam. September of 2015, we wrote an article on Near East Center that said who should speak for Islam or who speaks for Islam. And in that process, we pointed out what the internal conflicts are. When Muhammad established Islam internally, he had a problem. He brought the Arab mentality, which was a Bedouin mentality of Sunni Islam, to the borders of Iran, which was a nation state in the past that had been a global leader, an empire in its history, and had a different mentality and approach, which was nowhere close to what tribal mentalities are. This is the reason why Iran is really Shia, and Sunni Arabs are, as they say, Sunni. And this internal fight was never able to be resolved even during Muhammad's time, because he realized that the two mentalities are completely different. This fight has been going on since the establishment of Islam. Turkey has always been trying to be the leader of Islam within the region, to be the head of the caliphate. Iran has always been able to project itself capabilities even within Sunni states as to the loyalties of the Shia Arabs to it. Saudi Arabia has literally not been able to do much, even though it controls all the various different holy shrines of Islam, given the fact that its only projective capability has been being a tribal society to write checks based on its oil money, which drives some of the internal fights that are taking place currently in Islam itself. So ISIS was one of the manifestations. Because of this fight, there's other entities out there, and those entities will eventually emerge over the next 10 years or decades.
Well, I wanted to, as you talk about the factions within Iran, would you say, and we look back to what was called the Green Movement, which did appear, at least from some of the reporting, to be a legitimate threat to the hard line, the mullahs there that control Iran. Was that a legitimate threat, perhaps, if it could have generated more Western support that could have been elevated to a point of being a threat to the hardliners? Or would that mentality still be considered to be a threat today?
That's a yes and no. The problem is, as I take the example of what happened to the Syrian Christians, every single Western nation, a Christian nation, had its multi-force structures in Iraq, but they still allowed the Syrian Christians to get butchered. And to this day, they still allow it to happen. Under the previous administration, we were talking about the Syrian army. When we went to the State Department finally and we told them, look, these are the missions we have accomplished. We want your support now to help strengthen us. They gave us two options. They say that you will have to go be under the Sunni Muslim Kurds, because a lot of people in the State Department, Department of Defense, even in press media, lobby groups, congressmen have bought into the dollars and the information operational campaign of the Kurds, that they're the best thing since sliced bread for us. Israel had a need for them because they were providing a short-term security need for them. So they were getting supported. And at the same time, we were told you would have to be there, or you would have to choose to be under the Hesh-i Shaabi, which is the Iranian-aligned militias that today are being targeted, not just by the U.S. from sanction-wise, but Israel has used its drones to attack them in Iraq on two different occasions just within this month. This is the problem that you run into, because when you have these green movements, you also have even our allies in the region who may not want to see them succeed. The reason they may not want to see them succeed is because they are all looking at Iran as an economic bazaar that they could develop over the next decade. And they would like to see a deal struck that's going to help them in the long run. When we struck the deal with Iran, Near East said that this was an economic deal and it was not a nuclear deal to save Europe. Europe undercut us in this deal, which is the main reason why President Trump, seeing that China was going to be isolating us globally, economically, has taken to fighting China on the tariff issue and has tried to bring the Europeans to in order to strike a new deal with Iran, that if there's any changes within Iran, that in the future we will have a say in their economy and as far as what their ties are going to be, either closer to us or Europe. I could tell you as of today, the British have educated pretty much every major and above in the Iranian army, their families, because they have allowed them through visas, open visas, to study in Europe. If there's a regime change in the future, if there are Iranian Americans who decide to go back to Iran, those individuals will probably not be marginalized because of the Iranians themselves in Iran. They're going to be marginalized by Iranians in Iran who are tied to England and others. Why? Because England remembers that it was the United States that initially came in and removed the Shah's father, who was a British lead, with his son, who was an American lead. And Britain will make sure that it will not allow the United States, being one of our allies, to ever have a stronger capability to affecting the politics of Iran more than Britain would for his own interests. So these are the reasons why sometimes these movements are not successful, because there's a lot of internal fighting they have to deal with that are tied to what foreign powers are trying to do within the region.
Well, as we look, and you mentioned earlier, as I referred to the situation in the Persian Gulf and the provocations in that overall region, that these are just really mechanics to try to essentially, if I'm hearing you correctly, these are just movements, or these are just moves by the Iranian leaders to try to get the U.S. back to the table to negotiate some sort of deal. Is that correct?
It is, and it is a means of by which we are using to maybe have an internal fight between these leaders to see who would come to the table. For us, in the short run, we don't care if the moderates or the hardliners come to the table, as long as they come to the table with our interests in mind. If they come to the table with a new deal, and I think a short-term deal, because you have to get to a point where you finally get to a treaty long-term deal with the Iranians, as long as it meets our requirements and our standards, we are going to approve that deal under the current POTUS. The problem we run into, and Iran has today, is that the current administration broke the previous administration deal. So from their perspective, they look at it and say, what guarantees do I have that if I strike a deal with you tomorrow, you won't come and have a new administration break that deal? Eventually, you got to get to a treaty, and the treaty has to go through Congress. Mm-hmm. And given how Congress is divided, you can see we're having problems just even agreeing on a treaty when it comes to cars with Mexico and Canada. And I imagine we're trying to strike a deal when it comes to nuclear and ballistic capabilities with Iran.
Well, and when you talk about the nuclear capabilities of Iran as they continue to develop nuclear weapons, that apparently it strengthens their position. And you think about a nation that has been regarded as a rogue nation for so long, and now as they get a greater nuclear capability, they have greater leverage, and you end up in a situation where you are on the verge of perhaps legitimizing a nation that perhaps should not be legitimized. What do you think?
Well, not just that. Nuclear weapons themselves are dangerous.
Sure.
Maybe you get 20% security out of 100 if you get your hands on a nuclear weapon. Look at North Korea. But that doesn't mean that there may not be a probability of 80% that that bomb may go off in your own country. North Korea has had to utilize those weapons in its own soil, which has damaged it in the long run, as far as this capacity is concerned. At the same time, today, nuclear weapons are still a danger. They're dangerous. They could be transported from place to place, even nations like Russia and the U.S. There's no guarantee that we are going to be able to keep our stockpiles safe. If you take a look at the perfect storm that happened that has got us to this position, it was the Three Mile Island incident at the same time that you had the Iranian Revolution that took us away from pursuing possibility nuclear as being the next fuel for us. And 40 years later, we're still somewhat tied to oil, and our allies are tied to oil. And even adversaries, which has led us to this position. So just because you have a nuclear weapon doesn't mean that you can keep it safe, and doesn't mean that it may not be used against yourself in the long run. And the issue we have, when we're looking at Iran as being a nuclear power, that does not guarantee that Iran is going to change and become a different mindset on the global stage, given the fact they still haven't resolved the fact as to why did we revolt, why did we establish an Islamic Republic, which has led to others wanting to have Islamic republics, even on the Sunni states, that has seen the entire landscape of the Middle East be nothing more than one big, huge dumpster fire when it comes to functional peace and security within the region.
Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari has been joining us today here on the Meeting House on Faith Radio, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. And what a fascinating conversation. And there is such a degree of interconnectedness. You have really, you've alluded to that throughout our conversation. There's a whole area, and I don't think the time permits us to really get into it today. But when you look at the connection with Iraq and, say, North Korea, that is, of course, an extremely dangerous alliance as well. And I don't know if it's something that you would want to try to even tackle within about 1 or 2 minutes, but what can people be looking for with respect to that relationship, if you want to address that briefly?
I think the biggest thing they need to look at is the fact that North Korea realized that they could not bring the major powers to the table until they pursued the nuclear path. Same thing with Iran. Iran just basically copied what North Korea was doing. And it has put the U.S. in conflict and competition with China, the next global leader possibly. And at the same time, it has put the U.S. in conflict with Russia and China when it comes to Iran. That being the case, that it seems that when you scream nuclear, everybody comes to the table, and be aware that this will be used by other nations if Iran is successful.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Sangari, if you would direct us to a website or two where people can find out more information about you and your work, that would be great.
Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. I've done multiple interviews on the subject, and at the same time, they can go to United Assyrian Appeal. We are still a 501c3, and the way we sustain the Assyrian Christians currently on the developmental scale is through donations that come to United Assyrian Appeal. Without those donations, it's very difficult for us to be able to keep at least those remnants of the force structures on the ground to secure the Assyrian safe havens.
Excellent. And Near East Center for Strategic Engagement is the name of the organization. There is a website address, nec-se.com, or people can just search for Near East Center for Strategic Engagement and find out more information about that. UnitedAssyrianAppeal.org is the website for that organization, correct?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. Sargis Sangari joining us here on the Meeting House on Faith Radio. Wow, incredible conversation. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for giving a voice to the Christians of the Middle East and the Assyrian ethnicity, where that voice is not heard on any mass media anywhere. So our prayers are for you guys to keep the good work that you're doing, and God bless.